The best of times, the worst of times, the age of wisdom, the age of foolishness, that actually rings true of our current day of age just as much as they did during the time of Charles Dickens. That, of course, is the opening of The Tale of Two Cities. I have misquoted there. If Charles Dickens were alive today, he might be part of the Occupy Wall Street movement. In fact, he was quite the social activist. And there's a lot been written about Charles Dickens, and yet what surprises us as we approach the 200th anniversary of his birth is what still remains to surprise us about this man. Claire Tomalin joins us now. She has a new book out called Charles Dickens, A Life, and she joins us from the studios of our partner, the BBC, in London. Good morning, Claire.
Hello, Celeste. It's very, very nice to be, as it were, in New York, which I should be, but I'm not.
Transcendentally, anyway. You know, let me ask you, I myself have read 4 or 5 biographies of Charles Dickens. In addition to this one, why do we need another?
Well, I think someone as big as Dickens can be looked at from many different perspectives. Writing about Dickens is like trying to write about 5 biographies in one, because he was a man of super energy and his interests went in so many directions. I mean, he was a writer, he was a great philanthropist, he did good wherever he could. He was an editor, he was a performer, he was a family man. With all the things he did, he liked to entertain himself by walking 12, 15, 20 miles a day. He couldn't live without taking that sort of exercise.
We're speaking with Claire Tomalin about her new biography of Charles Dickens, called Charles Dickens, A Life. You know, let me ask you something. As a woman, I'm wondering if you feel like you have a different view of Charles Dickens in certain ways. Number one, you have you're kind of strict in your judgment of his portrayal of women in his books, but you also really take him to task over the treatment of his wife when he became legally separated from her in order to kind of take up with a younger woman. Do you think that your biography of Dickens is in some ways influenced by your gender?
No, I think I've written about men, I've written about women, and I think his treatment of his wife, I don't think even his warmest admirers, among whom I count myself, can fail to see that he behaved very badly. Here was a banal situation, a middle-aged man is tired of his wife, falls in love with a young woman, and he wanted to appear to be in the right because he was a public figure. So he went to great lengths to suggest that his wife didn't love her children, the children didn't love her, that she had mental problems. He treated her appallingly badly. What I say in my book is I want to avert my eyes during that episode, because otherwise Dickens is in general such a good man. I think it's sometimes when very good people who aspire to be models to their time, to be exemplary figures, something goes wrong, they find it most difficult to cope.
You know, one of the things I found fascinating was something I actually, with all I've read about Dickens, have never really learned all that much before, which was the home that he started in cooperation with a philanthropist in London.
With Miss Coutts.
Right, yes. Exactly, lifelong friend, for prostitutes. And he was actually pretty astute, not only in his judgment of what was or was not possible in reforming these women, but also in taking a relatively hard line with people that he considered hardened. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, it was a remarkable thing. He gave over a decade of his life to running this home for homeless women, which, as you say, was for young prostitutes, street girls. His idea was not that you had to reform them. You had to show them that they could have something better in their lives. And he didn't really want too much religion. Miss Coutts was very keen on having a lot of clergymen preaching to them. Dickens said, no, what you want to do is to give them a humane environment, show them, they had little gardens, he had music lessons for them, he provided them with books, he wanted them to wear attractive clothes, and he knew that not all of them, it wouldn't work for all of them. But the idea was that for those who really saw the point, they could then emigrate to Australia or to Canada or to the South Africa and really start a new life and get married. And the fact is, some of them did. It was an extraordinary venture.
You know, I got to ask you, we're coming up on the 200th anniversary of his birthday, and perhaps one of the reasons why his books are still popular today is because they still seem so current. You know, I mentioned in passing in the introduction that he might be one of the Occupy Wall Streeters, but he could actually be on either side, right? I mean, his dad was sent to debtor's prison. He had a very poor and difficult childhood, but he ended up earning an incredible amount of money. Do you think he would stand with the 1% or the 99% at this point?
I think he might stand with the protesters. He really cared about the poor all through his life. Why? One reason he was so loved as a writer in England was because the poor of England read him. His books were put out in cheap paper-bound monthly instalments so they could afford to buy him. They were dramatised so they could go and see them dramatised in the theatres. And they absolutely knew that that's what he cared about, was the poor and the disabled and the people at the edge of society. When he arrived in Boston in 1842, one of the first things he said to the people of Boston was that he'd had letters from them about his characters like Smike and Oliver and Little Nell, people who were really outside society, and that he wanted his aim as a writer was to make people always remember such people and regard those people as equally deserving of human rights as other people. In England, he did a great deal to support colleges or institutions for workers. He would go around the industrial towns of England helping to raise money for those institutions. He was very generous privately. If a friend died leaving orphan children, Dickens would immediately raise money for them and continue to support them and take an interest in them. But he was also interested in public philanthropy of the kind I've mentioned.
And personally went around, I mean, your book begins with the description of him going to the trial of a young lady who was a young serving maid who was accused of murdering her child and saving her and then continuing to support her in the years ahead. I mean, it appears as though Dickens, not just novelist, but Dickens, the social crusader, is sort of the focus of your book.
I feel that's very true, yes, and that's why I started the book with that this was one of the great thrusts of his life, and you see it in his writing, and the Joe the crossing sweeper, Charlie the little girl who goes out washing to support her baby brother, and over and over again he makes into the main characters in his books these very neglected and poor people.
Well, it's a great read. It's the book is called Charles Dickens, A Life. Claire Tomlin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You can give us your views on Dickens or on something else we talked about this earlier about the younger generation looking to the parents' generation and grandparents' generation and feeling disappointed in their leaders. It's something that many of you had a lot to say about, and we're wondering what your response is to that idea. 877-8-MY-TAKE or post your comment to thetakeaway.org. You can hear that entire conversation at our website, or you can subscribe to our podcast. It's all at thetakeaway.org. I'm Celeste Headlee. John Hockenberry is out today. This is The Takeaway.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science. Neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.